Good afternoon. Welcome to Art Speak Radio. This is Maria Vasquez Boyd with you every Wednesday, noon to 1, here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I always have to look at the sign to make sure that this really is 90.1 FM. So thank you so much for tuning in today. We have a full studio of wonderful guests here to talk with you and talk to me about events that are happening around the city. And I want to tell you today we have Steve Velasquez, Anna Marie Tatera, and Dr. Jean Chavez. They're going to talk about the Kansas City Museum and the partnership with the Latinos in Baseball and the Barrios in the Big Leagues. Also on tap, we have Becky Robinson, who will talk about weaving influences. She's going to join me by phone. And then we'll finish the segment with Wayne Coutois, Ralph Seligman, Lindsay Bowen-Martin, and Sean Pavey, who will talk about the most recent book that is coming out, a lot of excitement about that. Give Me Your Lunch Money, Heartland Poets Speak Out Against Bullies. So they'll talk about that a little bit later in the second half of the program. So I want to tell you about the Kansas City Museum. It's one of the 10 partner organizations in the United States to participate in Latinos in Baseball in the Barrios and the Big Leagues. It's a multi-year community collecting initiative that was launched by the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Now, this collecting initiative will document stories from the United States and Puerto Rico and identify artifacts that reflect the social and cultural influence of baseball on Latino communities. Now, the objects could include baseball equipment, stadium signs, game memorabilia, food vendor signs, home movies, period photographs, and more. So the goal of the collecting initiative is to work towards the development of a traveling exhibition centered on Latinos and baseball by 2020. So we have Steve Velasquez, who is an associate curator for the Division of Home and Community Life at the National Museum of American History Smithsonian Institution. He's here to talk about the project, as well as Dr. Jean Chavez, I'll slow down a little bit, who's been an educator since 1966, and he is just a terrific historian, and he's going to talk about the Latino perspective with this exhibition. And then we also have with us, we've got the lovely Anna Marie Tatera, who is the executive director of the Kansas City Museum here off of, Gladstone Boulevard. Yeah, so welcome everybody, and thank you so much for joining me on Art Speak Radio today.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, let's start off first by defining Latino, because so many people have a different reference about what they think the meaning is. So would one of you want to begin with that?
Sure. When we talk at the Smithsonian Institution about Latino history, we're talking about all the different experiences that we would encounter throughout history, mm-hmm. of those Spanish-speaking peoples, from encounters, even Native Americans, all the way through today. So when we mean Latino, we mean the Mexican-American experience, the Central American experience, the Caribbean experience, the South American experience, those from multiple generations.
Mm-hmm. I would like to add to that, Maria, and that definition of Latino, think of it as an umbrella term that takes in all of the Latino world, including Spain and Portugal, because they actually are Latinos. If you talk about Brazil, it's a Latin American country. So the Portuguese-speaking Brazil is considered a Latin American country. So it's a very big umbrella under which many nationalities, many ethnic groups, because there could, as Steve mentioned, somebody could be Native American by ethnicity, but think of themselves as Latinos, as a Brazilian might, or let's say an Afro-Hispanic individual whose ancestry comes from Spain, but for all intents and purposes, they think of themselves as Latinos.
Mm-hmm. It is really complex, because I think many people have their own definition, and it is rather broad, like you said, sort of an umbrella, you know, description. But tell me how the sports and the Latino culture, how do they go together?
That's an interesting question. It's not relegated just to Latino communities, I have to say, first off. But for, I think, for the Latino communities, especially at the turn of the century, sports was a community get-together. It was an outlet. It was a social outlet. It was a way to become part of the larger community, not just their neighborhood, but the larger community of the city, of the town, whatever. And so Latinos in sports have a long history, and so that's what we're trying to document, make sure we get some of those stories, those early stories.
We could actually take that history back 4,000 years in Mesoamerica before Europeans came. They actually were playing communal games, ball games, throughout central Mexico and southern Mexico, including the countries of Guatemala and other Central American countries today. So they built huge stadiums where the community gathered and watched these ball games, and the remains of those stadiums are still there.
Beautiful. And then
I was going to say, I think for us at the Kansas City Museum, it's that spirit of building community. It's that camaraderie. It's that being able to come together across state lines that was really intriguing for the exhibition that we did last year that Dr. Chavez and I worked on for the Kansas City Museum. That was kind of the beginning of this initiative, and for us it's perfect timing at the Kansas City Museum as we reimagine the future museum. We're going through a process of redefining our mission and our vision, and that vision really is about being this hub of learning where individuals and communities come together to innovate, to have conversations, to collaborate, and really to build civic unity, because we feel that there's a need to go beyond diversity and inclusion and actually come together to build civic unity in Kansas City.
Now, the collecting of the artifacts and the history and oral histories, it began this year?
Well, actually, it actually has a long history. We have some colleagues, some partners who worked in California, Richard Santillan and Cesar Caballero from they started doing this type of collecting, very local, very regional, in California, maybe about 10 years ago now. And I knew about the project about 4 or 5 years after they started. And so that's how it got started. That was sort of the seed.
Right.
And then I sort of tried to cultivate it amongst my colleagues. And then one of my fellow curators took over and really pushed it to this level. So we've been at it for a couple of years.
Yeah. Well, and I'm just reading from the event calendar that, you know, it shows that sort of these, the collection of these artifacts and all began for this year, February, in San Bernardino, California, and then it went through Los Angeles last month, and now it's here in Kansas City, right? Mm-hmm. And then it will go on to Syracuse, New York. Now, I do want to mention that the goal of the collecting initiative is to work towards the development of a traveling exhibition centered on Latinos in baseball by 2020. That's a lot of work for you all to do.
Well, and it's a lot of confidence building in potential donors to the exhibit, because for many people, especially as I've worked with the Mexican-American community and other Latinos here in Kansas City, what I find is that they say, well, we'll let you make some scans, or we'll make you some pictures of the pictures we have. So it's a very near and dear to their hearts. You know, and as we researched and launched the Mexican Americans in fast pitch softball, connecting communities across state lines that we exhibited last year, we found that there is a wealth of information and artifacts and collectible things that tell a story.
Right.
Often that story is very personal, and people are a little reluctant to part. So what we've tried to do at the Kansas City Museum, and Anna Marie's been wonderful about helping me to build relationships with community partners, including individuals who say, okay, well, we'll let you take our precious artifact, show it, use it, and let it tell our story. So that has been a process, and actually started the process when I started collecting oral histories through a grant from the Kansas Humanities Council that was actually had some monies from the Smithsonian. And so that was part of telling hometown team stories that I started collecting oral histories.
Yeah, I'd like to add that, you know, a part of this initiative also, maybe fundamentally, is that families and communities of Latino heritage actually start to see themselves in museums, in collections. And for me, that was kind of what drove, that's kind of the seed that drove my work. It is the seed that drives my work, and so that's what's driving this project. You know, making sure those communities, those families, those pioneers are in the records. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know,
They have to. It's really important that they see themselves in these museums and all.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And as we start to understand what future exhibits will look like in the renovated Kansas City Museum, we're looking at really exploring and celebrating Kansas City through the lens of history and cultural heritage. So we need to look at our own collection, which is very vast, and understand how to really expand that so that we have the artifacts and the archival materials to tell all kinds of stories about individuals and communities in Kansas City. And we need those historical materials in order to do that.
Yeah, and talk about community history through the lens of baseball is perfect.
Yeah.
Right? You have the businesses that support them, the businesses that make them come together, the food vendors that help them, the stadiums where they gather, it's endless. You know?
Well, and I know here in Kansas City, there's such a rich history of baseball in the community.
Oh, yeah, Kansas City is a baseball town. I mean, the first baseball team that's recorded in our Kansas City history was a team called the Kansas City Cowboys, and they go way back to the late 1800s, the 1880s, that played right here in Kansas City, and of course we've had many evolutions of teams ever since. One thing I wanted to comment about the idea of documentation, I think part of the discrimination that the African-American community experienced was also experienced by the pioneers that Steve was talking about, the people who came here from Mexico. They were often relegated to second-class citizenship. There was discrimination, just the same way that the Negro Leagues experienced discrimination. So the Mexican-Americans formed their own teams, and they overcame, I think, the effects of discrimination by saying, hey, we can excel just like anyone else, and you talk about America's game, well, it's our game also, and there were tremendous players, many of whom eventually worked their way into the big leagues. But even when you look at professional baseball today, there is a lack of Mexican players. You have a lot of Latino players from Dominican Republic, from Puerto Rico, from Cuba even, but you have very few Mexican and Mexican-American players. And I think as our society changes, it becomes more inclusive, we'll actually see more inclusion in the large numbers of Latino players that play in professional teams. And so we at the Kansas City Museum are trying to do our part.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you about more information about the collecting initiative and event details. Do you have those for us to share with our listeners?
Absolutely. So it kicks off really on Friday afternoon. We have a panel discussion. Jean, do you want to describe the panelists and what they'll be talking about? Starts at 1:30 at the Kansas City Museum.
Yeah, the panel actually will include Steve, who's with us today, also Eduardo Diaz, who is the director of the Latino Center at the Smithsonian. We'll have the gentleman who did the biography of Mike Torres, who grew up in Topeka and played with a lot of the Mexican leagues in the area, and his family, the longtime baseball and fast-pitch softball players. Jorge Iber, Dr. Jorge Iber from the University of Texas at Lubbock, will be one of our panelists. We'll have Diego Seguí, who came here from Cuba, way back in the 1950s, was scouted and recruited by the Kansas City A's and worked for Charlie Finley, both here in Kansas City as well as in Oakland, California, when they moved. He'll be one of the panelists. He tells a fascinating story of leaving Castro's Cuba and coming to the United States. And we have a young man by the name of Paul Briones, who actually is a nephew of Tony Aguirre, very well known in Kansas City, the Latino community, who started women's basketball among Latina women here in Kansas City on the west side. So he'll be also part of that panel.
Beautiful. And I want to mention the Kansas City Museum is located at 3218 Gladstone Boulevard, and the website
is kansascitymuseum.org.
Terrific. Because I know there's a whole listing. It kicks off at 1:30 and it goes through till 9 o'clock where there is a summer concert that is free, I can say that.
Yes, Enrique and Diego for making movies.
Yeah, that's going to be a great way to top that day off. And then the following day, Saturday, there's another full day of events and lunch and collecting the materials and all. And a reception for former players at the Kansas City Museum and collecting the historical materials.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, this has been a bright spot for the Latino community, wouldn't you say?
Yes. I think the Latino community, especially former players and their families who were very much involved. You know, when a lot of these Mexican teams, like the Aztecas, the UCM, Union Cultural Mexicana, Wildcats, and others played, they used to draw huge crowds. I mean, hundreds of people would fill the stands, and there was a great coming together of the community and experiencing that a sense of ethnic solidarity and camaraderie.
Beautiful.
That took place at those games.
And Steve, are you finding this throughout the cities that you're visiting and going? We'll soon be in Syracuse after this.
In Syracuse.
You're finding this?
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's a common story. Mm-hmm. And so I think what makes this exciting is that we have regional partners. Kansas City Museum has been a great partnership. And we hope to expand this a little bit in the near future and see what happens. But certainly the community has been really engaged, and so we're hoping we get some great objects that will either stay here in Kansas City or be collected nationally for the exhibit. So.
And it's really important, just as it's important for us to have materials at the Kansas City Museum so that we can do local exhibits and programs, it's also really important for Kansas City to be part of the national narrative and for objects to go to the Smithsonian. That's a real privilege for us. We're really honored to be a part of the partnership in that way. And now's the time with our World Series status and the Urban Youth Academy happening, being developed. Mm-hmm. In Parade Park. I think for us at the Kansas City Museum, it's really important for youth to understand where they come from, their heritage,
absolutely,
their culture, to understand the history for many of the youth that play in leagues. And we feel a tremendous responsibility to provide that level of educational and learning experiences.
So ultimately, the goal is of this collecting initiative is to work towards the development of a traveling exhibition centered on Latinos in baseball by 2020. But Steve, I'm going to put you on the hot seat. So when will the Smithsonian have a Latino museum on the grounds?
Oh,
Washington D.C. Come on now.
That would take longer than 2020.
I would say. Well, no, we're grateful for this opportunity. I'm sure all the cities that are involved in the communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, for us or for me and my colleagues, Margaret Sellers Porzio, who's heading this, it's really important for us to document, like I said, document the Latino experience throughout the country. Each one is slightly different. And each one brings an important perspective and topic to the discussion about Latino history, about community history. And so it's going to be fun, but also challenging to tell national story, but with regional flavors. But again, you know, it's all about making collections, making those stories available and collected throughout the country.
So. Absolutely.
And these events for us are the beginning. I mean, this is a multi-year collecting initiative locally. Really, the goal is to collaborate with other cultural institutions to be able to tell the full scope of these stories in a very, you know, multicultural way. So we're hoping that leaders of other cultural institutions here in Kansas City will participate in these events and then want to join us in this initiative over the coming years.
Yeah, that's an important point. Since we have the National Negro Leagues Museum here, you know, many of the Latino players that came were of African descent, so they played in the Negro Leagues and had a very active part in the Negro the development of the Negro Leagues. In fact, the person who developed the Negro Leagues was himself Cuban Latino of African heritage. So that's an important collaboration that needs to develop. And so this is just the beginning, I think, for the Kansas City Museum to begin to develop those relationships.
Yeah. And I would imagine, Steve, on some level, I mean, that with the new African American Museum of History and Culture opening in September in D.C., I'm sure there will be collaborative opportunities.
Yeah. In future cities that we're going to, we have another colleague at the new African American Museum who's also part of the project. He's also going to be telling, collecting these stories as well. And so there's going to be ample opportunities. The exhibits are just one one way. We like to tell these stories, create educational tools through websites, through books, through teacher programs. And so we hope to develop all those in the future. So
now, the website for the Smithsonian, I know that they have Latino history and culture page there. AmericanHistory.si.edu is the website. And would you give us the information again about where to get more information or details about the collecting and all that of memorabilia?
Oh, absolutely. So,
and a phone number.
KansasCityMuseum.org. And when you go to that homepage under collections and under programs, we have it in two sections. You can find the full listing of events on Friday and Saturday and more about the collecting initiative. And you can call 513-7568.
Beautiful. Any final words, last words?
Well, it's been a great opportunity for me to tell the stories. And as I interact with the Latino community here in Kansas City, they always express appreciation for what the Kansas City Museum is doing. And now the Smithsonian that will put some of their history out there so that people will know their experience. And so it's a great opportunity for us.
My final words are, if you have any memorabilia from your grandfather, your great-grandfather, your father, bring them to us. Jerseys, signs, equipment, photographs.
Are there things that you won't take?
We'll evaluate each piece as it comes. There are many different, with any museum, there are many different issues that we have to look at before we actually take something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we'd love to be able to see it, get an idea of what it is. And I
guess my question should be, I mean, if it's something of a rather large size or a bulky, I mean, it's not going to be discounted as like, we don't have room for this. I mean, you would still kind of check that out and see
yes.
A row of stadium seats might present a problem, but we could probably work it out. One thing that I would emphasize in the objects is the importance of the objects telling a story, telling their story.
My final words is really thank you. Thank you to the Smithsonian. Thank you to Dr. Chavez. Thank you to others who really helped to create the look and feel of this initiative. Luis Garcia, who did our beautiful logo. John Garcia, who created our jerseys for the Los Sabios game on Saturday. It really is a group effort, and we're really grateful for that.
Terrific. Well, congratulations to each and every one of you, and we look forward to hearing more as this rolls out, and keep me in mind. Keep us in contact.
We will. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to be right back with ArtSpeak Radio right after this. and you're listening to Art Speak Radio. This is Maria Vasquez Boyd with you every Wednesday, noon to 1 o'clock, here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Next up, we have Becky Robinson, who is the founder of Hometown Reads and CEO of Weaving Influence, which is a company based in Lambertville, Michigan. They partner with authors and thought leaders to grow their online influence and market their books. It has grown into a team of more than 30 skilled professionals offering full-service traditional publicity services and website development, in addition to social media work and book launch promotion. While they primarily serve authors and thought leaders, Weaving Influence also works with corporations, small businesses, and nonprofit organizations. Welcome, Becky. Are you there?
I am here. Thank you so much for having me, Maria.
You bet. Thank you so much for calling in today. Now, you, I got an email from your people at Hometown Reads and Weaving Influence. There's a local connection to authors here in Kansas City, right?
Yes, absolutely. So my team and I launched Hometown Reads earlier this year, and our idea was that there are authors in every hometown who are longing for an audience. And Maria, I don't know if you've noticed, but there are tons of books out there, and there's a lot of noise. It's hard for authors to get noticed.
Yeah.
So my instinct is that there's no way yet on the internet until we started Hometown Reads, which is the first website of its kind. There's really no way to identify the books by authors in your own area. Mm-hmm. And so in developing Hometown Reads, our goal is to showcase authors in their hometowns to help them find readers locally, to create an opportunity for connection where authors and readers can connect. And then from there, you know, if people love the books that they're discovering in their hometowns and they happen to share on social media, that would help that author reach more readers everywhere.
That's
so
great.
We actually were contacted by a local author named Joyce Brown, who's in the Kansas City area, who saw what we were doing. She and a group of writers in the Kansas City area already had a Read Local movement beginning, and when they found our website, they asked us if we could start a page in Kansas City for them, which we did.
Wow. And what I understand is Hometown Reads, which is a division of Weaving Influence, again, it's a full-service digital marketing agency that provides web development, graphic design, social media strategy and implementation, digital publicity, and more. So it's all a kind of a one-stop shop, would you say?
Yeah. So my core company definitely has comprehensive services for authors. And the thing about that, though, Maria, is that oftentimes our core services are expensive, and many independent or emerging authors can't afford to invest. And so what we were looking for really is a way to provide a free service that would help authors get some exposure and publicity. You know, I've learned a thing or two about book marketing in the years that I've been doing my company, and I really wanted a way to give back and share what I know about book marketing if it can make a difference for others. Now, I'm sure along the journey we'll find some people who would want to participate with other services that we offer, but really what we want to do with Hometown Reads is to have something be, you know, it's completely free right now. Any book can have a page. Any author can have one book on the site. And in that way, you know, maybe that author can't even afford a website, but our page can be the center of their marketing efforts. Or, you know, maybe through the site they meet other authors who can share with them about some ideas about how to market their books on a shoestring. So we really want to play up this community aspect of authors partnering with each other and convening in communities to help one another reach more readers together. You know, anyone who writes a book invests so much time and energy and money to bring that book to the market, and they care deeply. If it's a story, they care about the story and the characters, and you know, they've pored over those words and sentences.
Yeah.
If it's nonfiction, they care about the message, because you know, who would spend that much time and energy about something they don't care about? And so I really like feel for these authors and have empathy toward them, and I want them to be able to reach people who would benefit from their work.
So it looks as though authors and readers will both benefit from the service. Weavinginfluence.com is the website, and will that give them with this website, will you be able to find out about the different authors, titles, books that are available?
Well, so if people want to discover the books by authors in their hometowns, the website to visit actually is hometownreads.com.
Okay.
So if you're someone who loves to read, you can come to Hometown Reads, and as we mentioned already, we already have a site for Kansas City. It's actually one of the biggest pages that we have of any of the cities. Right now we're in 14 locations, but we're expanding and adding new locations every week. So if a reader comes and their city isn't there, they could maybe search by genre, because we have many genres represented on the site. So if you love romance, you could see all the romance books that we have represented, or you can search other genres that you enjoy.
And so you also list that you you want to learn from the people that are visiting the website, and you can send ideas and suggestions or features to you?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, if there are listeners today who are authors who would like some help with marketing their book, would like to have their book up on Hometown Reads, you can actually join very simply by going to join.hometownreads.com, or you can always send me an email, becky@hometownreads.com. I'll make sure the correct person on my team can get back to you with relevant information. And if you have ideas about how we could make the site better and how we could more effectively help authors through Hometown Reads, I'd be open to hearing those, of course.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Becky Robinson. She is the CEO of Weaving Influence and the founder of Hometown Reads. Weavinginfluence.com is the website for more information. And thank you so much for calling in today and talking with me.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I appreciate the invitation, Maria.
You bet. We'll be right back with Art Speak Radio after this.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons.
And I'm Susan Sanders.
And this is Take Two, Two Takes, a movie currently playing in the Kansas City area. And today, the topic is a comic drama starring Viggo Mortensen, and it's called Captain Fantastic. And no, it's not the latest Marvel superhero movie. Far from it.
I thought it was a wonderful philosophical look at how you should approach our society. It's a tale like Swiss Family Robinson. This family lives in the wilderness, and seven children, all homeschooled. And from there, you go into the backstory of how all this happened.
Viggo plays maybe the almost saint-like father who has decided to live off the grid with his family. When his wife dies, her family tries to take the kids away from him, hence most of the drama of the film. But in some ways, I thought that the movie wanted to have it both ways. It wanted to say that Viggo Mortensen was a great dad and he was doing everything right, and at the same time he's doing everything wrong. But I guess that's sort of how life is.
I really felt if it had ended 15 minutes sooner, it would have been powerful. But when they went into how they handled their mother's funeral at the end, I thought it veered off into a ridiculous, cheapening ending.
This movie is an anti-materialistic film in a lot of ways, and I think that it's really well acted and an interesting movie.
Yes.
I just think that the downside of it is that it wants to have it both ways and is not quite sure which position to take on itself.
And maybe the audience is to decide.
Correct.
There were good points made for each position.
But it's an intriguing story just the same.
Oh, yes. The father's force of nature holds this family together, and that's a success. There's a lot of love in this family.
I'm Russ Simmons.
And I'm Susan Sanders.
And this is Take Two.
Michael, the old geezer just down at the bowling alley. Wanting to know what's on the next Arts Magazine show.
Love my senior listeners. Now, rolling right along, Actors Theater will join us to talk about their drama, I'm Not Rappaport.
With plenty of Geritol, I'll bet.
Then later, dancer Billy Mahoney will be here to talk about her latest tap jam.
Can you tap to rap?
That's Monday at noon, Arts Magazine show.
And you're listening to Arts Speak Radio. This is Maria Vasquez-Boyd. So now, up next, we have a group of really talented writers and poets. The book launch that will be happening tonight at Uptown Arts Bar, 3611 Broadway, here in Kansas City. The title of the book is called Give Me Your Lunch Money, Heartland Poets Speak Out Against Bullies. Now, poets contributing to this anthology includes two former Kansas poet laureates, and they'll speak out about against bullying aloud. The poems range from illustrating bullying, not only during childhood and adolescence, but they illustrate bullying in the workplace, in culture, in politics, and facing the isms, sexism, racism, ageism, and so on, religion, marital status, military service status, animals, and even in scientific labs for humanity's greater good. And bullies can be diseases such as cancer, and voices inside our heads may bully us too. Now, some poems also display a bully's point of view. Now, the contributors include Annette Billings, Dennis Etzel Jr., Tina Hacker, Denise Lowe, Eve Ott, Jeanette Powers, Mary Frances Wagner, Sean Pavey, who's right here in front of me. Hello, Sean.
Hello.
And Lindsay Bowen Martin.
Martin Bowen.
Let me put you on there. Martin Bowen. I always get that wrong. Okay. And we also have Ralph Seligman.
Yes.
And Wayne Critoire. Also here. He's nodding his head. Yes. So, very good. Thank you so much for coming out today and talking to me. What prompted this Give Me Your Lunch Money?
Well, it originally started actually as a Facebook page that Gary Lechleiter set up, which was called Poets and Poems Against Bullies and Bullying. And after it had been up a little while, Dennis Etzel Jr., who is the other editor, had wanted to do an anthology and was looking for an editor to put it together, especially since he's recently a father of twins and has three other children.
Yeah.
And he's in Topeka. He
didn't have a whole lot to do.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, at any rate, so I said, okay, I'll do it. And I also knew a small indie publisher who is actually the president lives in Arizona, but I kind of am able to handle things from Kansas City, too. We have a P.O. box here. So we put it together and have some wonderful people. They all had to post on that page first. They had to, you know, if they weren't already members, somebody had to ask them to be members, mm-hmm. which I did with a couple of people who are very good and were Kansas City natives at one time. At any rate, so that's how it got started. And I've had a broader response than I thought as far as people being very enthusiastic about it. And there are actually 31 contributors.
Okay.
One of them used to live here, and Gary Lechleiter had posted something. His name's Christopher Howell. He's a pretty big name. And he said, sure, run it. So I do have a poem by him. And then the two Kansas Poet Laureates are in here, too. Former poet laureates, Denise Lowe Karen Miriam Goldberg.
I think I left her name off, didn't I?
Oh, well, there's like 30 of them.
But at any rate, since I have the four of you right here, would you care to go down the line and give me a little snippet of your work? And would you like to begin, Sean?
Sure. This is a poem entitled Paying Up, and I tried to tie it directly into the title of the anthology. You never had a chance, fat boy, with your love of books and talent for music, glasses thick as Coke bottle bottoms, lack of eye-hand coordination, and general inability at all things athletic. Sure, they were friends, but they never seemed to be around when the Houston brothers roamed small town streets looking for an easy target to make themselves feel better about the beatings they took at home.
Beautiful. Lindsay?
I'm going to read one from a new book of mine, Jim Morrison Rescues Me. This is all a fantasy. I want you to know I did not personally know Jim Morrison. Jim says he won't let me be bullied again. He floats out of the stereo, takes my hands, rubs my face, and adds, "We're leaving. Hiding in your room makes life too heavy." He lures me into a Chevy rumbling at the curb. Wind brushes our cheeks while we drive to the beach. Seaweed and moss scents lift our fragile spirits. A red sun seems to sear Jim's curls into fire while we lay on the sand. Winds, waves shuttle in cockle shells and oysters. We hear flamingos click while they entwine their necks, dip to hot rhythms and morph into pink Hispanic dancers. Gulls squawk and dip into water. Here, on this shore, Jim and I lie away from paparazzi, safe from critics, except those shaman voices reverberating in our brains.
Wow. Thank you, Lindsay. Ralph?
To the rescue. I saw them standing there all alone in the crowd, Matthew, Torgay, Ken, and Stephen.
No kids in my school. Not knowing anyone, not knowing where to go. I introduce myself in my limited English, in my broken German. I do not speak Norwegian, I explain to Torge. Yet we muddle through anyhow. They feel I've rescued them from loneliness and taught them the ropes. They do not realize that, while being guided by me, I was the one needing rescuing.
Thank you. Wing?
I have just the one poem. And it's somewhat lengthy. The poem is called Coriolis. And it's really one of the poems that I wrote for my husband, Ralph. And for people who might not know, the word Coriolis refers to phenomenon that people often think of when they see water swirling down the drain at home. And there's always been this story that water swirls down the drain in opposite directions in the northern and southern hemispheres. That's actually not true. It's kind of like an old wives' tale, although there is a Coriolis effect that does affect clouds and storm formation in the stratosphere. Really, this is just more a poem about two people who are meant to be together but come from different hemispheres, and it certainly touches on bullying in both of our lives. Coriolis. 50 years ago, swept up in a life I tried to care for, rules stringent, pleasures few, I didn't, as the song says, know about you. I lived in the hard scrabble north, while you lived down the crooked road in the bloody southern hemisphere, where water swirled down the drain clockwise. I couldn't help when you were bullied and so alone. Nor was I with you at the theater in Quito, where an old Mexican horror film scared you to pieces. While your older brother stayed glued to the screen, you took refuge beyond the back row, hiding behind a misty curtain. You parted it enough to peek now and then through thick glasses, nervous left hand smoothing a cowlick, as the black and white nightmare drained the blood from your face. It was the catacombs, and the bones had come to life, shrieking in terror. Even an infant stirred, a hole in its skull crying for mama. Scratches and static in the old film added to the horror, as if it wasn't meant to be seen. And you made a choice. In the gloom and dust of that theater, Spanish dialogue cracking in your ears, you chose not to give in, not to horror. If you had to hide or look away or deny what was happening, you would. You chose survival over torment, the willingness to let the curtain fall. Meanwhile, in the northern hemisphere, where water swirled down the drain counterclockwise, I stood in a 6-foot snowdrift, waiting for the school bus. Fat kid in a parka, watch cap pulled over my ears, snow blowing in my face. I wasn't sure, when the bus shouldered through the gloom, it was really there, till it creaked and sighed to a stop. I knocked my numb feet against the door to clear snow from my boots. My glasses steamed up, snowflakes melted from my eyebrows and eyelashes. The bus lurched, I swung into a cold plastic seat. How long till I could feel my toes? One long ride past many fields and a few houses later, we reached the school. I struggled down the path to the gate, placing my boots in boot prints that went before. I didn't expect to stay upright for long. Sure enough, a push from behind landed me in a snowbank. Hands pulled my hood back, shovel snow down my neck. I'd be wet and cold all day, my feet thawing out, then freezing again at recess. You could say I was numb from the neck up as well. Eyes lowered, voice squeaking. I never took the practical path, choosing between sanity and horror. My winter went on forever, while you fought the good fight, sweating out the days when bullies had their ways and the future looked grim. Perhaps we were connected even then, tears swirling down our faces in different directions, meeting in the middle. Turns out that swirling thing is a myth. Coriolis doesn't care about our personal drainage. It has more important things to do, far above our heads, like making cyclones. Here's what matters. Turning in our separate spirals, we found each other, chose survival over agony, and vanquished the horror of our early years, the difference in hemispheres.
Wow. You know, that each of you read such powerful pieces, and, you know, I wanted to hear the voices all together, and collectively, a really, really good writing, really solid, and identifies, you know, that the emotions that you feel, you know, when you are bullied. You know, it really does. It captures that. Uptown Arts Bar, you'll be there tonight from 7 to 9. Will there be books available?
Yes. Yes, and they are also on Amazon. And soon there will be some in Prospero's and in Reader's World and Lee Summit.
Okay.
Prospero's.
Here. We just can't give out prices, but
right.
Yeah, they'll be available.
They'll soon be available. And we will have a few tonight. And there will be about 13 readers, 13 uh-huh. to 14, and maybe some more. I'm not sure about some people. I know Denise Lowe is uh-huh. out of town because she showed interest in coming, but she wasn't able to. And if we have time, I'll read her poem.
Well, I just want to ask, was this difficult for any of you to sort of the subject matter to write about this? I mean, some of you may have written just maybe from experience or maybe witnessing something, but was this a difficult topic for any of you? Yeah, Ralph?
Actually, when I saw the Facebook page, I'm the type of writer who does not write off the cuff, that I have to have a call for submission or some motivation. And this resonated with me so strongly because I was bullied when I was a child for many different reasons. Mm-hmm. And I felt the need to write. And once I wrote, it felt quite cathartic to express the things that I've told some people about it, but to write it in with care, to make it into a poem and let it out of my system, it was really an invigorating and positive thing to do.
Now, did any of you feel the same or similar feelings?
I was just going to say, I used poems I'd already written, and oh, yes, I mean, I'm, you know, one of those sensitive poets that you look at me wrong and I worry about it, so I'm probably very easy to bully. I kind of looked for themes because I wanted something a little different besides this, you know, the stereotypical bully, and that's why I did write another one about cancer, because I've seen it bully people, really.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, the interpretations that one will have about bullying. And Sean, how about you?
I had seen the page and didn't really have anything to contribute at the time, but then Lindsay reached out and I thought, you know, what the heck, I'll jot something down. Yeah. But I was a tubby kid who loved books and music and was really bad at sports, so I was an easy target because they could catch me. I had those experiences to draw from. It got to the point for me in high school, I ended up playing football and not well, but I was big enough to be a defensive tackle. And, you know, for somebody who writes poetry and plays oboe, you almost have to be on the football team to keep from getting beat up every day. So, at least they knew I could hit back. And so that's when things changed for me. But, I mean, we still deal with that every day.
Oh, yeah.
Politically, even.
One of those guys is running for president.
Politically, even. We'll just leave it at that.
Well, and you know, as a kid, I, you know, when I would witness, you know, these
somebody
sort of
else.
Things happening, or it happened to me, I thought, okay, now when I become an adult, that will change. And it really doesn't. It just takes a different sort of form.
It changes, but it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
One of those dreams.
What do you think, Wayne? Yeah.
Oh, I think that...
You can just come up to this, rather than move it.
Yeah. I think writing is always difficult, and I think every topic is difficult to write about.
Yeah.
And if it's not, then you're probably not doing it right.
Yeah.
I'd have to vary. Some of them, I've had poems that are this many drafts, but others, sometimes they just come, the muse is on, so it's hard to say. Mm. Yeah. But I did want to say for this book collection I did, like with Sean and a few other people, I brought in some ringers that I knew wrote good poems. Mm-hmm. Hey, join the site.
Yeah,
and they
yeah.
were like, oh, wow, yeah. I really, you know, and I was... The response that I saw was greater than I anticipated.
Well, you know, and that's what I was going to ask next was, you know, with the response, and, you know, everyone has a story, whether it's, you know, something very small and very subtle or really something
violent or threatening.
Yeah.
And
do you see a part two to this? I mean, could that very well take place?
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was like the sexual harassment and the domestic violence. And
well, I mean, give me your lunch money part two. I mean,
a
second sort of anthology
see.
Of poetry.
We will see. Might be. But, I mean, some of the poems in here deal with some very heavy things. Like I say, I was surprised, several child abuse, sexual child abuse poems.
Yeah.
And some domestic, and then some more subtle ones, too. And then from the bully's point of view that... I was just kind of amazed, you know, and very pleased since I was editing this. It made it an easy thing to do.
Now, since we only have a few more minutes left, I want to ask each of you if you have, besides this Uptown Arts Bar launch of the book, Give Me Your Lunch Money, Heartland Poets Speak Out Against Bullies, do you have any other upcoming events or anything that we should be aware of that you want to announce on air? Sean?
Well, I've got a reading coming up in Pittsburgh, Kansas, not this weekend, but I think next Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the month, I've got two or three readings. We're still working on the details lined up in St. Louis. So.
Terrific. And you'll keep us posted on that?
Sure.
Very good. Lindsay?
I will be reading September 9th, and I will read some from this book as I did in Johnson County. But James Binger and James Binger and Jeanette Powers will be reading this Friday and may read from this book. I know James plans to. James will be here tonight, too. So just Friday. And like I say, mine's September 9th on a Friday at the Writer's Place. It's a riverfront reading.
Oh, great.
It's at 8 o'clock.
And James and Annette are reading at the Writer's Place as well.
Yeah, Jeanette and James are reading with Riverfront this Friday. And again, it's 8 o'clock. Their riverfront readings are later at the Writer's Place than the regular ones. So.
Very good. Ralph?
I don't have anything coming up. When I write, I write for a specific subject, and right now I don't have anything going on.
Very good. Wayne?
I don't have anything scheduled right now for reading.
Well, I know
you do.
But
I appreciate Lindsay putting this together, and... Maria, I appreciate your having us here today.
Oh, you bet.
It's been great.
Well, I know you two are very busy. You lead active lives and that. So I just wanted to give everyone an opportunity to tell us about upcoming events. And Give Me Your Lunch Money, Heartland Poets Speak Out Against Bullies, tonight, Uptown Arts Bar, 3611 Broadway Street, Kansas City, Missouri, 7 to 9 p.m. That's this evening. Lindsay Martin Bowen. Yes, I got it. Sean Pavey, Ralph Seligman, and Wayne Coutois, thank you so much for coming in this afternoon and talking with me. Best of luck to you with this book. It's got some great poems. The ones that you've read so far, beautiful. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you for having us, Maria.
Thank
we appreciate it.
You bet. Come back soon. And that closes out another afternoon of Art Speak Radio. I want to thank Steve Velasquez, Anna Marie Tatera, Dr. Jean Chavez, Becky Robinson, Lindsay Martin Bowen, Ralph Seligman, Wayne Coutois, and Sean Pavey. Next week, August 17th, we'll have Frank Juarez on phone. He's going to talk to us, and with him in the studio will be Joe Bussell and Larry Thomas and Bruce Burstadt. I want to remind you to stay tuned next for Jazz in the Afternoon with Jeff Harshbarger. He's our dear friend and a very talented musician. Thank you so much for tuning in this afternoon. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Podcasts are available of these each show on our website, www.kkfi.org, and through iTunes. So thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate you you turning us on. So with that, I'll sign off, and honey, I'm coming home.